This is Talking Ears. And this week, we're going to be highlighting the work of CAOC, the Council for Accreditation of Occupational Hearing Conservation. In its current state, it was formed in 1973 with the task of training all the hearing conservationists. That's nurses, doctors, audiologists who perform hearing testing and hearing loss prevention training in industrial and occupational settings. Our guest for this episode is Terry Tyson, who I first met when we both joined the CAOC Council, representing our respective professional organizations. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about Terry's musical life, his guitars, and his feelings and thoughts about acoustic design. And we'll also be discussing our work on the CAOC Council. In this episode, we'll be listening to music featuring our guest, Terry Tyson, on guitar and some vocals, with his band High Noon, a Southern rock tribute band. But we're going to actually start this episode by asking Terry to explain what his job is.
I'm an architectural acoustics consultant, fundamentally. The company that I work for is called Ascentech, technology company that specializes in solving acoustics problems, but there's some allied technology things that we do as well. My role at Ascentech has to do with any kind of built environment, if you will, where sound is important. Easiest example is a concert hall, you know, interior design of a concert hall so that it sounds great for natural acoustics. And that is the most prominent and the sexiest example, if you will, of what acoustics is all about.
Well, the day of the city, well, the brighter the lights, bigger the dog, well, the harder the bite. I don't know where you've been last night, but I'm thinking, mama, you ain't doing right. Said
there's a lot of more real-world examples that everybody sees in their daily lives, like multifamily residential buildings. They're meant to be designed to a particular standard where you don't hear your neighbors readily through the walls and you don't hear them readily walking around on the ceiling, you know, above your head. And very often, they don't live up to the standard that they're meant to. That's a thing that we get involved with. If an architect or developer comes to us in advance, we can guide them in the way that they ought to go in the design of those partitions and floor ceiling assemblies. And sometimes they don't, or frequently they don't. And maybe we hear about it after the fact when there's a, there's a complaint,
sure.
And we try to help them with that.
Yeah.
Here's a really good example. You can't build a K-12 classroom in some parts of the country. You can't build it at all unless you've taken into account interior acoustics in those spaces. And this is a really important thing because it's all about speech intelligibility in those spaces, particularly for younger minds sitting in a classroom. If you've got elevated levels of background noise and it causes the lecturer or the teacher to be even a little bit indistinct. Your younger person doesn't have a lifetime of context to fill in the blanks or what they're. So there's that. Also, rooms in many old buildings are all plaster. There's no soft goods in. They're overly reverberant, and so that increased level of reverberation in the space, combined with maybe noisy HVAC if they have HVAC at all of those things contribute to a degradation in intelligibility in those spaces. And so you can't build one of those rooms in many states. You can't even build that unless you take that stuff into consideration. And so we get involved in the design of those kind of places as well.
The way you talk about the classroom acoustics is exactly in line with like how audiologists talk about it of decay and intelligibility factors and background noise and signal noise ratios.
Yeah.
A lot of what you're talking about then is, I guess you would label them as, would it be comfort or convenience or aesthetics?
Yeah. I like to think of it, and I don't know if there's standard language to use it, but when I'm communicating with a client or potential client, we talk about designing a room for acoustic comfort, if you will, mm-hmm. you know, so that the room ought to sound, it, you know, in a funny way, the room ought to sound the way it looks like it should sound. In a classroom, you know, if you're in a large atrium space, like a very high space, and it's overly absorptive, you get too much acoustic absorption in the space, and the sound, you don't hear any life in the space, any reverberation in the space, it feels weird. And if it's not necessary to have a high degree of speech intelligibility in that space, then designing a room that's like that is counterproductive, and it's you get a disoriented in a space like that.
Yeah.
Intelligibility issues aside, that the rooms ought to have a degree of acoustic comfort. A conference room, for example, ought to have maybe a little bit of life, but not too much, because if you have too much life in the space, teleconferencing becomes a problem. There's audibility problems that way. And concert halls, I mean, or multi-purpose rooms, of course. If you're designing a room for organ or choral music, you want it to be really live. You want it to sound like a cathedral. But if you're the same room, you want to use it for musical theater or a rock band, that kind of level of reverberance absolutely doesn't work at all. And so all of those things have to be taken into consideration when you're involved in the design of one of those rooms.
I'm imagining that you don't, that you're not a fan of cafetoriums in schools.
That's very funny.
Is that a stretch?
Well, you know, I mean, the funny thing is just the basic cafeteria without the auditorium component. There may have been some acoustic attention paid to the design of a school. Mm-hmm. So the classrooms, the so-called core learning spaces, they call them. So the core learning spaces are designed properly. And maybe even the gymnasium has got a degree of acoustic absorption and stuff. So it's not overly reverberant and the HVAC background noise is controlled. But you get into the cafeteria and nobody paid any attention to that. They built a cafeteria. And I tell you, it's these cafeterias for these younger kids, I think there's a great analogy to a band rehearsal room.
Yep.
These kids, they're loud. They make these shrieking. That's a shocking how young people, what high frequency they can generate. And the cacophony in these places, if you don't have sufficient cubic volume of the space and a sufficient amount of absorption, those spaces are nightmarish. And it just somehow flies under the radar. People don't think of those spaces for acoustic control. But the people who have to work in there ought to be wearing hearing protection, frankly, because the constant level of background noise in there during those hours when the kids are using the space is bad. It's really bad. So,
well, I'll pick up your lead there to get us off of schools into the cafeteria. But after this joke,
yes,
that the cafeteria is like the core learning space for social cues for kids. So it's kind of sad that like we're just like smushing their ability to hear. We're turning it into like, you know, the bar section of Applebee's is the level of conversational clarity that they get when they're trying to learn how to be people.
That's well said. I never thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right.
Especially the Applebee's part.
Yeah, especially.
Well, with that, we can flip the table a little bit and start talking about how you came into KAOC then, because the KAOC consideration for acoustics is it's got some overlaps, I imagine, as far as the intelligibility, but it's more functional for protection purposes. And so we want to see how all of this acoustic conversation relates to protecting these little ears that we have.
The council, effectively the board for KAOC, is made up of delegates, if you will, from a variety of different disciplines. Audiologists, and there's otolaryngologists, and there's people in all of the disciplines related to hearing. My connection to it is that I'm a delegate from something called INCE, the Institute of Noise Control Engineers. There's two delegates from each of these different professional organizations, and I'm the junior INCE delegate, if you will. But as an acoustics consultant, there's a few professional societies that we often belong to, like the Acoustical Society of America is one example, and the Institute of Noise Control Engineers is another one. I'm a member of that. I mean, there are people from a variety of backgrounds in there, but a lot of us are acoustics consultants. Maybe not necessarily everybody doing architectural acoustics, but noise propagation outside, mechanical equipment, mm-hmm. stuff on the rooftop propagating out into the environment. Control of airborne noise, environmental noise sources is something a lot of us are involved with that way. Many of us don't have very much to do at all with dosimeters, for example, or industrial noise levels or what people are allowed to be exposed to in the workplace. We do know generally how to make the calculations that'll show how sound will propagate and whether it's going to then be in alignment with whatever the local noise ordinances are. And those things vary all over the map depending upon where you are.
And so KAOC has a lot to tie in with industrial noise, especially, or occupational noise. And their mission is to deal with noise-induced hearing loss that happens in an occupational setting. Have you had experience personally with doing that kind of, let's call it noise controls or engineering controls of industrial noises?
Candidly, not as much as some other members of INCE do. We do get called, for example, the next week I'll be doing a site visit to a very well-known industrial company who has a noise problem on their plant floor. It's too noisy. They've taken some cursory readings using a cell phone or something, you know.
Sure.
And it would appear that probably they don't have a legal issue. You know, they're probably not exceeding an issue that would call for people to absolutely have to have hearing protection, but they are asking us to come in and opine on how they can make the place more comfortable because it is still grating to be exposed to these noise levels for 8 hours a day if they don't have to be.
Good on that employer for caring beyond the legal requirement of exposure and actually caring about, you know, fatigue and stress of their employees.
Yes.
That seems, I'm going to guess, relatively rare because it's not cheap to do a lot of these acoustical changes.
There's a backstory naturally, you know. So they're consolidating some operations and they're moving people who currently work in an environment where the noise is better controlled. And when the leadership of that other unit was informed, we want you to move your operation to this existing building, he went in there and said, oh, no, I'm not having my people move into here, you know. So you guys have got to make this better. And they've got all kinds of exposed equipment inside the space that isn't what they have at the other unit. And so they're looking at us to opine on, you know, what it might cost them to make. And frankly, I'm not sure if they feel obliged to do the work anyway, you know, but they want to at least know what would be involved to improve the space.
Again, hats off to them because I feel, I don't have a good statistic on this, but I feel like the vast majority of even recommended legal requests to change and reduce sound sources for noise exposure reasons don't move forward because they cost either too much or because they're perceived to cost too much or they don't see the long-term benefit. So for companies to say, hey, look, you know, this noise is bad. It's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It inhibits communication, it inhibits people doing their jobs correctly, it inhibits people being happy at their work because it's like working inside a jet engine. Let's help out. That's really cool.
Right.
That's really cool. When Juan and I are teaching these courses, we're often talking about kind of the work that you do in a third-party perspective, right? We're talking mm-hmm. about noise measurements, noise controls, considerations for rooms. And I feel like hearing it from you is so much more clear because, you know, we frankly don't go and do what you're doing. Mm-hmm. I'm just, you know, intrigued by this concept that we are multiple parts of this same organization of KAOC, trying to get out there and reach the nurses and the medical assistants who are taking these classes and becoming educated in the mm-hmm. topic. Oddly enough, most of the course directors happen to be audiologists. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's because of our background in hearing testing, that it makes sense to teach hearing testing, but 80% of what we teach in the class is not hearing testing. Most of it's noise and stuff that you've been talking about.
Yeah.
What was your first exposure then to KAOC? Was it just somebody sent you an email and said, hey, there's an opening on this board and are you interested?
I confess, absolutely. Yeah, I really had no knowledge of KAOC. Mike Batarian is a former president of INSE, and he happens to be a colleague of mine at my company. And so I learned that somebody from one of the INSE delegates was rotating off. And gee, there's an opening there. Would you like to do that? And I said, sure. What does KAOC do? Because mm-hmm. I didn't know. And so that was it. So I spooled up as quickly as I could, and I turned up at a meeting, and here I am.
Nice.
So it's been great, though. It's a subject that's actually near and dear to my heart because mm-hmm. we get in a lot of band rooms. I mean, there's a band room is a great example of a room that is frequently too noisy for the instructors who have to work in them,
yep.
and too noisy for the young people who have to play in the band room. They're very often completely inadequate to the task. And that's something that one of the greatest, most rewarding things I can do in my work is imagine, a 100-year-old school building in a Chicago or a city, anywhere, where it's a 100-year-old room and they're using this room as a band room. And it's way too small. The ceiling's way too low. And it's way too loud. The great thing that is so rewarding to me is they finally get a new room or they finally get a new building. They get a new facility and they've had some acoustic attention paid to the design of that space. And now it's like, you know, it's a great sigh of relief when you're in there and it's actually pleasant to be in there and to work in there and to perform in there. And particularly for young musicians, I think that's just for me, particularly a happy thing to do. So
nice. And you came to this, you're not only in a lot of band rooms, you're also up on stages, you're also in rehearsal spaces. So you came to this also, I don't know if that connection occurred to you when you heard about what KAOC does of, oh, protecting people from noise, I make noise.
Oh yeah, I'm guilty. Guilty is charged, and I have a notch in this ear to prove it, you know.
Oh yeah.
You know, standing next to the drummer, and there's a cymbal, you know. And so, for sure. I've been playing music in bands for decades, and mm-hmm. It comes with the territory that way. And actually, as it happens, I didn't come right into acoustics out of school. My undergrad is in chemical engineering, actually. Hmm. So I spent first dozen years of my career in industrial environments where there was no concern. You know, you wore hearing protection, right? But some of the stuff was incredibly noisy. So I stumbled into the world of acoustics later on in my career, but I know firsthand what some of those places are like. And it's, you know, it's bad.
Yeah.
Very often.
It's nice to have that background.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that it gives you more empathy then when we're talking about the industrial settings that you've kind of stepped foot in those spaces?
It probably does because I know what it's like. Mm-hmm. My job in those days, I wasn't permanently attached to a manufacturing facility, but I traveled around the country and went to lots of different cement plants and chemical plants mm-hmm. and stuff. And I would, every week I might be somewhere else. And I've been all over the world doing that kind of thing. So I definitely know firsthand what that's all about. And I've got a little bit of hearing acuity loss, I guess, mm-hmm. and myself, but that's largely from playing loud music. So I'm certainly sensitive to this.
Yeah.
I got that green
and I first connected when we both realized that we like making loud sounds come out of guitar amps.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about your music life.
When I'm not at my day job, I have a band. I'm working. There are times in my life I was in multiple bands, and I've been in bands for, like I said, for decades. Mm-hmm. But I currently have a band that plays around the northeast of the country, and we play big festivals, and we play in theaters, and we play in, you know, music halls and stuff. And it's a rock band. It's a Southern rock tribute band, and so it's very guitar oriented, and tends to be loud.
to get loud.
yeah. Glad to give a nod to High Noon for sure on the podcast, but we're playing other people's music as it is.
You know,
we don't have any original music, so
our
mission in life as a tribute act is to replicate as closely as possible the sound of those original recordings that people remember from the late 60s through the mid 70s that they loved when they were in college or they loved when they were in high school, and they put on that, and we try to play everything note for note as much as we can, and all those songs we wish we'd written them ourselves, but we're playing other people's music every night.
Well, now they call me the breeze. Mr. Breeze.
There's a real joy to playing cover music, though. I've been playing in a Beatles tribute band for a while, and there's such joy because you don't have to convince the audience that they like what you're playing.
Well, that's exactly right. Exactly right.
In any kind of original music band, where you write your own songs, unless they're there to see it because they bought your record, you're trying to sell yourself the whole time.
Absolutely.
What's your favorite guitar right now?
In the band, right, I am the Strat guy.
Yeah.
Because in this genre, you got to have the Les Paul guy and the Strat guy.
Yep.
So you got to have those. These are particular sounds that have to happen. So I've got several Strat type guitars that I play in the show. But my favorite guitar is one that I never play in the show. It's an old Gibson ES-175.
Oh.
It's a jazz box.
Yeah.
And that's the one I love to sit around home and plunk on that one. That's a lot of fun.
Nice. So, what year is it?
88, I think.
Beautiful.
And it's unusual because the typical one is maple body back and sides. And mine has got a mahogany back and side.
Really?
Yeah, and they made them that way for just a few years, so it's a little bit of a rare bird, but it's beautiful physically, and it sounds great, and it's classic, and I really enjoy that one. So
the way it's supposed to be.
I guess I'm curious, especially as a guitar player, where did you start, when did you start, and why did you start? I think a lot of the times the why is from hearing something in particular for the first time. So curious as to what your starting was like.
Okay, so I remember it was the summer of 1974. I went out to Southern California with my mother on a vacation. And we went to go see some people that we used to know from Chicago, and And the boy who was my age had moved to California. He was starting to play the guitar, you know. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever, right? And so, and we went around. We spent a week or so there. And I remember distinctly, everywhere you went, and this is the L.A. Anaheim kind of area. Every store you went into, their guitars hanging on the walls, their guitars for sale everywhere. It was the era of, you know, the Beach Boys and the Eagles and all these things were happening and everybody wanted a guitar. And so I wanted one too. So I got a guitar after we came back home. I got some kind of guitar. And I tried, you know, and it was kind of an aborted attempt because, as was so often the case back in those days, cheap guitars were almost unplayable most of the time. These days, you can get a cheap guitar that's perfectly playable, yep. And it doesn't sound like a fine instrument, but it's perfectly playable. But back in those days, it was a real handicap. If you didn't mm-hmm. meet a certain threshold for spending money on something, I set it aside for a time. But the big revelation for me, guys that are a little bit older than me, they always point to one thing. It was the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. They stayed up late that night and they saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. That changed their lives. So you look at any of like the big rock stars now, they'll all talk about that. I was a little bit too young to experience that. But for me, it was Kiss on the Midnight Special in 1975.
Nice.
And I will never forget stumbling. Well, the Midnight Special was a late night music program that was on the weekends. And I'd watch it. And one day, this band Kiss came out there with the makeup and the fire and this all that, and I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life. So for me, that was the moment that I said, "All right, that's it. I got to get this guitar thing sorted out. I got to do this." So
Kiss brought you in, brought you into the ranks.
They really did. It's a little funny thing to say, but it's absolutely true. You know,
and they're wearing the leather and the armor from early on too, right?
From the very beginning, yeah.
Basically looks exactly the same as they looked when they played their last show last year.
They've gained a little weight since then.
A couple million listeners, a couple pounds. Who's to say?
Exactly.
Yeah, the camera adds a couple, I heard.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Played in bar bands and bands mm-hmm. that play in casinos and stuff, you know, just late night, you know, the band in the bar. I've been doing that my whole life. And we stumbled into this tribute thing a few years ago. And it's taken us to a different level because now we're able to play venues that charge real money to, you know, for people to come see the act. And they know, as you said, Frank, they know what to expect. You know, they're coming to see a Southern Rock tribute act. They're going to hear mm-hmm. Give Me Three Steps. They're going to hear Ramblin' Man. They're going to hear mm-hmm. Freebird, you know, so
yeah,
but I tell you, at the end of the night, after we've played this music, you know, for 90 minutes or whatever, 2 hours, we meet people afterwards, and there's guys who are older than me who are, you know, emotional because they'll say, "You brought me back, you brought me back to college, you brought me back to my high school years. It's great, I never heard a band play this stuff this way before, and it was perfect, mm-hmm. and it was great, and it was, you know, so meaningful." And then, so we make a lot of friends that way, which is very rewarding. So
I've never played in an established tribute band or cover band, but the ensembles I was in, that's how we would usually rehearse and get new ideas for original material, is by covering Black Sabbath songs or Iron Maiden mm-hmm. and Pink Floyd. Yeah. And we just sort of took a lot of structure and songwriting strategies to kind of create what we had wanted to play. And I think deep down, subconsciously, I think there was that component of why, you know, you, Terry, are loving playing in tribute bands, is because the crowd, the audience, they'll experience something that they once did before. And to kind mm-hmm. of connect to that, and how allowing the power of music and sound mm-hmm. can really bring back a memory. And that's actually something that Frank and I do talk about fairly often when we're giving the Chaok courses, is mm-hmm. this is why it's important for us. Surely it must be important to some of you, but not just to us here within the class, but loads of people you know, in the public. And so if we can identify one thing that connects us,
yes,
surely it's got to expand to so many other things, which is, I think, why Frank and I love working with Kayak, is because we are able to share our passion with other disciplines, such as yourself. Having that connection, is that something that drives what you do?
Well, it definitely does. I mean, at least in so in the band part of my life, there's nothing better. You're playing what would be better is if I had written the song, right? But I mean, if you start out in the first few notes of "Can't You See" by the Marshall Tucker Band or "Midnight Rider" by the Allman Brothers Band, you play, people immediately get it and they start cheering immediately, and then they're singing along the whole time, and they make a very sincere, heartfelt connection to what we're doing our best to just reproduce. You know, we're just we know how to reproduce it, and they love it, and they love us because they love it, and there's a wonderful experience there that way, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
It's like serving people pizza, right?
Yeah,
like nobody needs to come up with new pizza. I don't really care about original pizza. I want to walk into the pizza place and be like, "This is great."
Yeah,
right, you know, right on. It's very. Yeah, it's very rewarding. But like Juan's saying, like that brings us back to protecting hearing and protecting ears and saving people's ability to have that experience for a lifetime. And I know firsthand from both patients, family members, folks that we work with who lose their ability to go and enjoy a concert, to lose their ability to even turn on a record and understand the lyrics anymore. Or, you know, I have friends who are musicians who have major hearing issues. When they go to bars or when they go to clubs or when they go to a restaurant and there's background music or a person playing, they get mad because ruins their ability to have, like you said, acoustic comfort and ability to have a conversation. And they're kicking themselves thinking, "I'm mad at another musician?" Like, how horrible is that because of the damage to their ears, because of the loss? So this brings us all the way back then to, go figure, Kayak and protecting those who are exposed to noise. So now your role on the council is stepping into the chair of the noise committee. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Kind of what is the task that they've been charged with right now?
Well, right now we are charged with, and there will be no doubt there will be additional charges brought, if you will, but
topical.
But we are currently just in the process of reviewing the existing materials that Kayak has already produced and trying to see how they can be improved upon and brought up to date, and that's really the extent of it, so that we can deliver a noise course version 2. That will perhaps provide even more useful information for people who take the course that way. So we have all of that information, though, about how noise impacts, you know, people have hearing issues. A great example, you mentioned people who go into a public place and their hearing is already damaged and they have all kinds of problems.
Oh, turn it up.
I became acquainted with a social club in Philadelphia area of people who live in the city, in Philly, and they do things together all the time, and they have lists of things that they recommend people do, where they go off in groups and do these things. And they keep a list of restaurants that are friendly for people with hearing issues.
Is that related to the sound print? Are you aware of sound print?
I am not.
Juan, have you heard of this before, the app?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I know the app. I have it, use it. And yeah, I think it's wonderful.
Would you be able to describe it?
Yeah. So it's basically a free app. You can essentially do a sound level reading in the environment, and you can rate it good, moderate, or poor as to what the speech intelligibility or the needs of your communication are like, and is it a good place to actually go to a public space, bar, wow, restaurant, or whatever, not limited to just bars and restaurants, just retail stores, or even a gas station or a grocery store, you know.
Wow.
It really does give patrons a bit of a voice when it comes to noise measurements, especially to somewhere where they may enjoy going, but maybe something happens or changes. And so there is a quiet list, either on the app or the website, that you can check mm-hmm. out. And in various different cities, you can actually make a relatively well-informed decision on where to go based wow. off of those ratings. And so
it sounds exactly like it. I think this group that I was invited to participate, probably 10 years ago, maybe before they had the app, but they actually had me participate in one of their events on a panel. We did a presentation along with an audiologist and a person who designs restaurants.
Nice.
And the complaint that they cite is that you go into a restaurant and I can't have a conversation across the table from you. I don't have profound hearing loss, but I have a little bit, and I can't make out the consonants, and I can't understand what you're saying, and I have to lean in to, there's a result, they wind up, we don't go to that restaurant yeah. anymore. We tell everybody not to go to that restaurant anymore. And it's a wonderful irony, or it is an irony anyway, is that it seems to us, and the person who designed restaurants acknowledged as much, that, well, okay, yeah, it costs money to control noise in those places because they need a different degree of interior finish and they need to control noise from exhaust fans and whatever else. But they're less inclined to even worry about that because there is the people who are the patrons of those places very often, they like the buzz and they feel like there's yeah. a buzz in this room. It's elevated sound level. And that means there's something happening and people want to be there. Young people want to be there and spend money. And so we're less inclined to worry about how noisy it gets because, you know, mm-hmm. why should we, you know?
Yep.
Again, the morning's come. Again, it's on the run. Sunbeam shining through his hair.
I love the idea of more people recognizing that sound level is one of the factors that they can make a choice out of.
Right.
The lighting in a space, the quality of the food, the rudeness of the staff, mm-hmm. ability to park. Oh, and also, is it quiet enough to have a conversation?
Yeah, right.
Whether or not you have a hearing loss, that's a huge consideration for folks who are in the know about sound. And it's cool that it's becoming more of a, I guess, part of society to think about
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue maybe too slowly, but
yeah.
It's nice that it's moving in that direction either way. With your work then on KAOK, because KAOK has a lot of reach.
Mm-hmm.
As you mentioned, covering a lot of different professionals from a lot of different organizations. Mm-hmm. We're training something like 22,000 occupational hearing conservationists every year, which are
wow.
a variety of nurses and medical assistants and physicians and administrators and safety coordinators. I have industrial hygienists who take the course. And so the way that we present this information, both the online noise course and the KAOK OHC course, the Occupational Hearing mm-hmm. Conservationist course, I think the way that we present this can embolden and spread this concept that we all here think is very important, that hearing doesn't need to be damaged over time. Hearing needs to be protected and revered and appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really glad to hear that even though you hadn't heard of KAOK before, once you heard kind of what was going on behind the scenes of it, that really
mm-hmm.
lit a fuse under you. That's really exciting for me.
Oh, it totally did. I mean, there would have been any number of things I might have volunteered for as mm-hmm. an INS guy, but I can't think of anything that would be more meaningful than what KAOK is doing. This is incredibly important and very meaningful to me. So the work is very, very worthwhile.
And you're unique in the sense that you're coming into it with industrial background, having worked in those spaces. You're coming into it from having created very loud noises with your guitar and doing your due service there. But I can't help but imagine that a lot of other ints folks, or really folks from numerous different walks, would feel the same kind of, oh, of course, this makes sense.
Yeah.
How do you think that we can do, I don't want to say do better, I want to say, how do you think we can continue that progress of getting the news out, getting the information out about KAYAK?
That's a good question. I'm not sure what the best means would be for letting people know. But the truth is, of course, now I've been out in the world for, you know, a long time, and I had never heard of KAYAK.
Yeah.
And I knew about what industrial hygienists were, sort of. It was the guy who'd come and hassle you to where, you know, you'd show up at the cement plant. Hey, you got to wear this. And you know.
Right.
You know, there would be a safety guy, you know, you gotta have this, and you gotta have the right shoes, and you gotta wear hearing protection. If you're gonna go into that building, you gotta have hearing protection. But that was kind of the extent of what I knew. And I knew that there were safe levels that you could be exposed to, you know, that OSHA would state. But in those days of my early part of my career before I was involved in acoustics, it was, you know, I didn't have any deep depth of knowledge of it. And because I wasn't an employee at a chemical plant, I worked in a design office and I would go out to these places. I wasn't exposed to this. It wasn't part of my daily routine. It was just, I'd go to these different places and have these different experiences. Then when I got into acoustics, that wasn't our initial focus. There are some acoustics consultants that specialize in the industrial workplace, for example, who would know this stuff on a more, you know, from they do it more often than I do. We work in other areas where noise is a nuisance. It's a problem because it's picked up by open microphones. It's a problem because, this room doesn't sound good, or intelligibility is a problem. It's not a problem because it's dangerous for most of the work that I'm involved in, you know, so. So all that to say, I didn't have any knowledge of KAYAK. But I think there would be tons of people who are engaged in the work that I do who would take a deep interest.
That's awesome. And, you know, not dangerous, but detrimental is how a lot of sound ends up being, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not dangerous, but it's reducing our effectiveness, it's reducing our quality of work or quality communication while we're working.
Yeah.
And having that be part of the conversation of hearing conservation, hearing loss prevention, you know, if I had any criticism of kind of the hearing loss prevention mission that we have, it's that we're only focused on that end of it, the extreme end where people actually get broken. But there's a lot that happens before that if we can help people, like Juan said, appreciate how much sound matters to their lives, appreciate how much their ears matter, then we can actually get people acting a lot sooner.
Yeah.
You know, the goal of KAYAK is to make hearing loss occupational hearing loss a thing of the past.
Right.
And I think the way to do that is to not deal with just the pain point. It's to deal with the societal perspective on sound and hearing. And you're doing that work right now. So I actually see you as the front line. We're the cleanup crew trying to deal with after all the china's been broken in the china shop. You're walking in trying to tell the bull to leave.
It's so funny, Frank. In our business, most of the work that we do is not in the field. We do a lot of design work we work for architects who produce a set of documents, and I review the documents, and we review it for, you know, are these walls adequate? Are the interior finishes adequate? If they're not, what should they be? What about this mechanical system that serves this space? How should we attenuate the noise that comes from that? We do all of that stuff on paper. And at the end of the day, a set of documents for a renovation or design of a new building would include the acoustician's recommendations. And then it goes to a contractor who has to build it. And I cannot tell you how many times the contractor says, you don't need all this stuff. I just built whatever, and it's fine. You can't hear nothing. That's a verbatim quote.
Yep.
You won't hear nothing. And they built a big box store, for example.
Sure.
And where they've got rooftop air handling units discharging directly into the occupied space, and they're really loud. But it's all about the perspective. You know, those guys, they don't see that as a problem. But when you're designing a space that people have to live in and work in and be a part of every day, it's a big problem. And the difference between a background noise level of, you know, of 40 dBA, for example, or something, versus 60 dBA. Neither of those are going to cause long-term hearing damage, but it creates a stress level in the space. It makes people uncomfortable, and it's not appropriate for certain kinds of spaces, for sure. And then we deal with that all the time, but some have a different perspective, and they don't recognize that at all, but we do, you know.
Of course. Again, it's bridging that gap. It's letting people know that sound matters, not just when it's too loud.
Yeah,
I do wonder about nuisance sound. I'm not sure your experiences or thoughts about community nuisance noise.
There are a couple of things come to mind in terms of the community. If you think in terms of environmental noise sources, the big thing, you ask any acoustician and they will tell you outdoor pickleball.
Huh?
Yeah, right. And I had not heard of pickleball until we started getting phone calls, and you get homeowners associations, and they want to put a pickleball court like out, 100 feet away from our back doors. And is that going to be a problem? And what can we do about it? And it's a game it's a very fashionable game these days that people are playing. And it's a type of paddle and ball game.
Sure.
And it goes clack, 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 clack. And it's, it's one of these funny things that doesn't exactly fall neatly into, ordinances about sound being emitted, but it's a nuisance and people hear it through their windows or their glass. And so that is a thing that is out there. There's also a very big thing, interior buildings where you have, say, a commercial building with multi-use commercial building, and they maybe offices or clinics or whatever, retail. And then in goes into the unused space, in goes a fitness facility,
right,
where they're dropping weights or they're throwing weights. And that's a tremendous problem, right? That you hear that sound, it radiates throughout the whole building. And those are the kinds of things that create a problem. The interruption of the work of the people who are on either side or above and below one of these places is a very serious problem that people have to contend with that way.
Mm-hmm. I like to think of nuisance sound kind of like I think of nuisance smells. Like if your facility is putting out, like, you know, if it's a fart factory and it's putting out fart smell, 24/7, then it's going to be bothersome. Is it dangerous to those around you? I don't know. Probably not. But if it's just putting out this horrible, noxious scent, if you live next to a Starbucks and you hate coffee, that's noxious. But I don't think anybody would be happy in that space, right? And they wouldn't be labeled as a grump telling kids to get off their lawn by saying, like, that space is that thing is too smelly. But I feel like that's kind of how nuisance sound is handled, unfortunately, is I'll get over it. It's just people playing pickleball. It's just kids in the park.
Yeah. It's a real thing. Their ordinances are designed to control nuisance sounds at property lines often. And in a residential community, you can't have exterior equipment like condensing units for your handling unit that exceed a certain sound level at a property line. And those are pretty commonplace. But you get a commercial facility that goes in there, like a doggy daycare is a great example. Doggy daycare comes in, and it, you know, you don't have to be next door to that to hear that. That sound travels a long way.
Sure.
The barking dogs, and the whole community is up in arms about that. And there's no graceful way of controlling that. You know, you can't put a wall around the doggy daycare. It's not going to make any difference. The sound is going to go over the top of it. So, shooting ranges, another one.
Yeah.
You know, the sound of gunfire travels an awfully long way, and
sure.
That's a thing. That's a community nuisance, and that's a little more unusual than the sound of the restaurant that went in and has a noisy exhaust fan on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
But all of them are issues that affect our quality of life. We want to be able to enjoy sitting out on our back porch in the evening and not hear the whine of a exhaust fan or barking dogs or whatever. And it's definitely a quality of life problem that way.
Mm-hmm. Leaf blowers, it's a big one.
Yeah, for sure.
My neighbor with their bad music selection in the summer. And I think the way that we all get kind of antsed up about nuisance noise, one of my main goals in life is to find out whatever that enzyme is, whatever that thing is that's causing us all to go nuts about nuisance noise, and apply it directly to loud noise in general, and just kind of, you know, we have the mechanism in place to get people upset and excited about sound. It's just being mislabeled, I think. Sometimes I'm when people, don't you take my mama, whiskey, rock and roll. You had mentioned that you were experiencing some balance, some ear-related issues. Are you interested in talking about that
and
how that's impacted your music life?
Absolutely. So, and I think this is the cause of it. We're not 100% sure, but about 15 months ago, I fell down the stairs at home, landed on my head. Frankly, I thought I maybe had knocked some teeth out or something. And there was no obvious damage as it turned out. I got up and I was okay. But then a couple of days later, all of a sudden, I started having vertigo. And I started it was incredibly, I thought I was having a stroke because my whole field of vision was rotating. And it was a frightening experience. Mm-hmm. Anyway, long story short, lots of doctors later and so many months later, it's still with me. And they've decided that it's what they called labyrinthine concussion. That's what the doc told me. So your inner ear is responsible partly for telling you which direction is up. And I'm getting a bad signal from this side, as it turns out. That's what they've decided it is. And it's basically, hey, there's really nothing we can do. You're just going to have to live with it. But we know that that's what it is because I got tinnitus on this side all of a sudden that came out of nowhere. And I've got... hearing loss at high frequency on this side is also, and these are apparently related. These are phenomena that show up when you have damage to your inner ear. I've been living with it. You know, I play music, and I sometimes find it hard to stand on stage with a guitar, so I sit a lot.
Mm-hmm.
All that to say, though, so many months have passed, and I've seen all the doctors. It looks like it's starting to clear up now.
Oh, good.
So I'm starting to feel less off balance. More often.
Yeah. The inner ear is a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
You know, we like to call it, at least I do, I won't speak for Juan because it's my dumb joke, but I like to call it a duplex organ, where it's like one of those houses with two front doors. And then one side of the house is the hearing center, the cochlea, and the other side of the house is all the balance and vestibular stuff. But the weird thing is they share all the same plumbing. And in fact, the cells are the same type of structure, so genetic issues that affect one affect the other, fluid issues that affect one affect the other, and they also share the same nerve. And so one problem that affects one, it's just like, you know, the roof is bad on one side of the duplex, you better believe the other one's going to have a leak sometimes. And man, it stinks that it happened to you.
Yeah, it's been very inconvenient. And you get to be a certain age and, you know, you're lucky to, if this is the worst thing I have in life, it's okay.
Sure.
I can cope with it. But it is a nuisance. I mean, right now I can hear this ear is singing like crazy mm-hmm. right now. And that's always there. But the balance might be starting to come around, and that's good. And it's there's like two different, I've learned a little bit about some of the distinctions between balance and motion sensitivity versus actual true vertigo.
Yep.
Cause I've actually had these vertigo experiences, which are really terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, when that happens, it's hold on to something and pray that it stops because there's nothing, you know, you can't function like that
no.
when the world is spinning. So, but I'm told, the experts have told me that it's, crystals that come loose inside your, the semicircular canals or whatever, and it's I tell people my gyroscope is, I got a gyroscope on this side and it's broken, so
that's exactly how it works.
Yeah.
And then the darn brain, it's got two signals going in, one good gyroscope and one bad gyroscope, and it just goes, I don't know. And the end result is you're spinning around. It's rough.
Good Lord, I feel like I'm dying.
When we met last, you mentioned sitting down while you were playing. And I was trying to imagine playing Lynyrd Skynyrd sitting down. I was trying to imagine Allman Brothers, I could play sitting down, right? But like there's certain stuff in your set that you describe where I'm like, does that make you feel uncomfortable on stage just in general?
Yeah.
Or?
It does. It does. And so I have avoided to the greatest extent possible sitting while I'm actually playing.
Sure.
You know? But what I found is, for what it's worth, I would benefit, I don't use a cane, but I would kind of benefit from it if I did, because it gives you a sense of feeling grounded. And so I'm lucky that I my position on our stage when we play as High Noon is I'm stage left, far stage left. So sometimes there's a stage wall there, there's a column there, there's something there. There's something that I can just touch. It's all I need to do is just touch it. Exactly. Even if I just touch it, and if there's nothing there, as precarious as it is, I'll just touch the mic stand. Now, the mic stand, of course, is subject to to falling over. But I find if I just kind of, I feel like, all right, because I have, as a guitar player for the band, I've got a pedal board of things that I got to kind of get up and stomp on these pedals. And even for that instant being on one foot, I feel like I'm going to tip over.
Yep.
So I will frequently reach out, just touch the wall, click the pedal, or touch the mic stand and click the pedal, and that gets me through. And then in between songs, or when there's the piano solo is going on, I might just kind of come back, sit down on the stool, and but I don't play. I don't typically play anything solos or stuff. You know, sitting down. I mean, they said, oh, it's okay. You're like B.B. King. It's all right. He's a B.B. King set at the end of his career.
Yeah.
You know, but I try not to. So.
Yeah. It's a different experience, right? It would be like if you had an entire orchestra stand up, it would be as awkward, I think. I don't know if all of our listeners have had the experience of being on stage with the lights and with the strange feeling of being slightly elevated on a platform that's not the sturdiest.
Yes.
And then, like you said, you're standing on one foot whenever you're changing pedals. I personally fell over, it was probably about a year ago, I was playing keyboards, and I just literally fell over on stage because I'm doing things with my feet. I tripped over some chords. The lights are strobing, and it's awkward. It's a tough, weird situation. I almost, whenever I see this video of those pop stars falling over, I'm like, nobody should be laughing.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
This is a job hazard.
It is. That's the thing. When we're going to play, we'll have a chat with the sound guy and the lighting person ahead of time. And do you have any special requests for the lighting? I say, yeah, those gobo things, those things that spin, they'll have lighting effects that project down onto the stage and they're moving. I say, please don't do that, because that I'll corkscrew into the, corkscrew into the trap room.
I guess, Terry, I'm curious as to, given your history, what you do, and really talking about this passion that we share.
Yeah.
What is your favorite sound?
Birds. Birds. I like I like the sounds of songbirds. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if I had to say something, there's nothing better that, you know, the beginning of spring is starting and all of a sudden they're back, and I love to hear them in the morning. So yeah, for what that's worth, that's, and I'm not skilled enough, and I have meant to be, I have tried to be, but I'm not skilled enough to identify the species or whatever. But I find I love listening to them. So. Well aware and warned by my parents, you know, don't listen to that music so loud, you know, when I was a kid, right? And so, and I didn't care, right? And so I was 10 feet tall and bulletproof when I was 14 years old, right? Those days, they had, like, headphones with these big cans, right? I had these old Koss headphones, and I turned my stereo up as high as it would go and listened to Black Sabbath or whatever, because the sound moved me in a certain way. I had a chair in my room, I'd sit there and I'd have this on, and it just was, there was something about that was just thrilling. It just moved my whole body. And I, you know, I'm gonna lose my hearing when I'm 40 years old, who cares?
Well, thank you very much. That's Terry Tyson again, making that one sound so pretty.
I want to just go back to a quick sentiment, which is the more that we can get all the professionals in occupational health settings or even occupational health settings adjacent, such as INTS, right? Mm-hmm. All the noise professionals to be aware of the simple call to arms of hearing loss prevention.
Yes.
I think that we're going to find that we have more counterparts, that we have more allies on this on this journey than we think.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with us about your work, about your music.
My pleasure.
Frankly, I just look forward to continuing to work with KAOK with you. And
absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. This was awesome.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
It's a pleasure, Frank. Thank you, Juan.
Talking Ears is a production of Earmark Hearing Conservation. The theme music is by Scott Hallam. You can find more of his music at audiodowsing.com. The show is produced and edited by Juan Vasquez, Scott Hallam, Mary Kim, and myself. Thanks for listening.